And joining us now is Josh Sewell, who is a senior policy analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Sewell.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And your organization, of course, it tries to make sense of the farm bill. And we've just recently had done a lot of coverage on the Republican Congress cutting food stamps out of the so-called SNAP program. And, of course, it's been revealed in a number of media outlets that while they're cutting back on food for poor people, we find out that many corporations and wealthy individuals are being subsidized enormously through the farm bill, and including Congressman Stephen Fincher of Tennessee, who took to the House floor and castigated the poor for not working. At the same time, he's a huge recipient of taxpayer money under the farm bill with these crop subsidies and these crop insurance subsidies. So how are you doing in terms of bringing common sense to this rather outrageous policy?
Well, I think we're making great progress. One of the issues that we're having right now is that in this farm bill, you have an economy right now, a farm economy that's doing great. And it's actually had some of the best years in the history of farming have happened in the last couple of years. And in fact, in 2012, you had record profits in the agriculture sector. And at the same time, we're facing near record deficits for a number of years at those same times they were experiencing their great years. And here we are now, facing more than $600 billion deficit. We have $17 trillion in debt. And so the solution, the contribution that the ag sector, that the ag committees are willing to do, is they're actually going to increase spending on corporate farming. They're going to increase spending on ag welfare, while at the same time everybody else is being subject to sequestration.
So why is welfare for the wealthy and big corporations and agribusiness okay and not welfare for the poor and the hungry?
Well, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons is the agriculture sector has a lot of lobbying power here in Washington. There are only a few dozen districts that have significant agriculture in them, and those members of Congress are fighting tooth and nail to keep every dollar that they can flowing into their districts. It's a very hypocritical thing, but money talks here, and you can see it in the priorities for some of these members for what they're fighting for.
And it seems that corn is at the heart of this situation here. I mean, here we are talking on Thanksgiving, and the myth or the mythology of Thanksgiving is that the Native Americans actually saved the colonists who weren't the best farmers in a hostile and foreign land, and they gave them corn. I believe they had turkeys,
right.
Or maybe they gave them a turkey as well, but corn was the operative thing, right, that saved the colony and which became
right.
The United States. So is that the explanation for so much corn subsidies?
Well, part of it is one of the reasons we subsidize agriculture so much is because it's the oldest industry. And basically every country, it's the oldest industry for every country. And so there's this mythical notion that we have to have agriculture in order to have that we have to support agriculture in order to have a good functioning society. And we've had such a federal intervention in agriculture for so long that it's a hard thing to shake. And interestingly, that there is, especially with corn is the largest cash crop that we have in this country. It's by far the number one crop grown in this country. There's more acreage for corn than anything else. There's more money going through corn than anything else. So there are more farmers. There are more farmers who are growing corn than anything else. And so it's the biggest interest group when it comes to special interests in farming. Now, the idea that it's interesting that you bring up the Pilgrims saving the Indians or the Indians saving the Pilgrims with corn. The kind of corn we're growing now never would have been seen by anyone who founded this country. The bulk of the corn we have now is not grown for human consumption. Almost 40% of it is grown to put in our cars in ethanol. And then the bulk of the rest is grown to feed cows and pigs and other livestock. So very little of the corn that's grown in this country is actually directly consumed by people. It's called feed grain. So we're feeding it to pigs and our cars.
Again, I'm speaking with Josh Sewell, who's a senior policy analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense, and we're talking about agriculture policy in this country and also the enormous farm subsidies, generous farm subsidies that are meted out that are arguably a form of right-wing welfare. At the same time, traditional welfare for people who need it is being cut. And my understanding is that the largest amount of farm subsidies in the United States, $85 billion in less than 20 years, has gone to the corn growth in this country, which takes up 60% of the crop insurance premiums that come out of taxpayer pockets, I might add.
Right, that's correct. Yeah, again, corn is by far the largest cash crop we have in this country. And when you're looking at the supports that we give federally to crops, about 80% of all subsidies, whether it's under crop insurance or other programs that send checks directly, go to just five major crops, and corn is the biggest of those, the others being cotton, rice, soybeans, and wheat. And so the bulk of the food that's actually on your supermarket shelves or that you're consuming wherever you get it receives little in comparison to those big commodities. Sometimes it receives nothing. And so it's a very interesting dynamic that you have here, where you have the agriculture committees saying that we have to send billions of dollars every year or else we're not going to have food to put on our tables, when in reality, I don't know anybody who's ever eaten cotton. And again, most of the crops that we grow as far as corn and soybeans is actually going to feed, you know, indirectly us by if you're feeding it to cattle and other livestock. But almost half of it now is going to feed our cars, which is just something that just doesn't make sense anymore.
So, Josh Sewell, you just were mentioning earlier that the corn that the Native Americans gave to the Pilgrims to save them, in effect, through that first winter, that was healthy food, but it bears no resemblance to the corn that we have today. You mentioned how much of it goes into cars through ethanol. I also understand that in food processing, and which is in many ways the source of obesity in this country, that the ubiquitous ingredient that sweetens so much of our food and it's causing diabetes and obesity is called high fructose corn syrup. So how much is that a part of this mix?
Well, high fructose corn syrup is definitely a byproduct of our subsidization of corn production in this country. Basically, what we've done since the 1970s is we've had an express goal of maximizing the amount of, they call them commodities, and they don't even refer to it as food anymore when you're talking about commodities of corn, and we have to find something to do with it. And so one thing that we've done is we created the renewable fuel standards, which requires significant amounts of ethanol to be blended into our gasoline. And then the high fructose corn syrup was developed as a way to dump excess corn into products to replace sugar. And so it's certainly been a contributing factor. And one of the solutions, it's amazing what you have happen here in Washington is when you have a problem that's either created or at least exacerbated by government policy, oftentimes the solution is, well, let's create up another government policy or another government program to mitigate for that. Well, one of the solutions in agriculture is just let's step back and stop meddling so much. If you are concerned about free markets, or if you're concerned about obesity, or if you're concerned about having a more dynamic rural economy based on local foods, the best step forward is to just stop the federal intervention from Washington. Stop picking winners and losers between crops and regions and say, let's let the market work its magic, frankly. And what we actually would think would happen is you would have a more dynamic, more robust agricultural sector if we stop picking certain crops over others and throwing money at them. And I think corn is a case in point for that.
But you were saying, Josh Sewell, that so much of America is covered in corn. It's grown ubiquitously. In fact, you can drive through several states and see nothing but corn. I've done that. And it's extraordinary how much of our farmland, how much of this prized arable land in this country is taken up growing the one crop, corn. And as you say, most of it's not edible for humans. Doesn't this have a very, very bad effect on soil itself? I mean, crop rotation, I understand, came in because farms were going fallow for growing the same crop year in and year out. So,
absolutely.
Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, corn is a very input-intensive crop, too, which means it takes a lot of fertilizer, it takes a lot of pesticides. And so what ends up happening is when you have the federal government and other government policies increasing the price of corn through these, whether it's through the renewable fuels mandate or it's through other policies that just promote corn at the expense of other things that could be grown, is you get farmers, it sends a market signal. It's one induced by the government that they should be planting corn everywhere they can. And we're seeing that there's no reason to rotate your crops if you can continue to get a lot of money for corn. And even if it fails because of crop insurance, you'll get your money back anyway. And at the same time, the massive run-up in corn prices that has been significantly influenced by government policy in the last few years has induced farmers to plant on marginal land. So we're talking the steepest land, the land that floods the most, some of the least fertile land, which is the most likely to fail and take the most amount of fertilizer, the most amount of pesticides. Farmers have an incentive to plant. Anytime the government tells you we're gonna choose one crop over another, we're gonna get more money for growing one crop over another, it makes sense for a farmer who's out there to make money to start planning for the government instead of the market. And that's definitely what we're seeing, especially with corn.
Well, given the lack of diversity in our agriculture and how much the government subsidized this one crop that we're talking about here on Thanksgiving, because it was, after all, corn that the Native Americans gave to the Pilgrims for their first Thanksgiving meal, this is how ubiquitous corn is in our food and our produce. You've got cornmeal, corn syrup, cornstarch. Then you've got maltodextrin, magnesium citrate, potassium citrate, caramel color, ascorbic acid, cellulose, ethanol, modified food starch, citric acid, hydrogenized vegetable protein, and high fructose corn syrup. That's just some of the byproducts. And then, of course, it goes not only into your gas tank, it goes into cosmetics, medications, vitamins, plastics, diapers, even matches and batteries. So they're finding all kinds of way to use this stuff, but it all feels like it all comes from the same source, which is this sort of dumb autopilot, zombie-like policies that we have.
No, it is. And a lot of those products are developed from taxpayer-paid research, which is also an important thing. So we create, through our policies, we create a glut of corn, and then through more spending, we end up paying for ways to find out how ways to just use that excess corn. It's interesting that you mentioned the Pilgrims and the Indians. What we tend to forget is that there were three things. It wasn't just corn. It was corn, squash, and beans. And so it was a more a robust founding agriculture than it was just corn as the center. And I think that's an important lesson for going into the future, is that we can't put all our eggs in one basket, and having one crop that's going to be the foundation for our rural economies and for our supposed energy independence is just, it's a bad idea. It's not going to work. And so we've seen that the price is too high. The price that we're spending subsidizing these crops is too high. And the potential ramifications economically and environmentally and for the rural economy is just too high. So it's time to step back and let the market work a little better, and the way to do that is to have the government not mandate what should be planted. Let's actually just pull back. We can keep a robust safety net. We can keep one that will actually help farmers when they're facing a crisis. But what we have now is we're not talking about crises in farmer country. They're experiencing record or near record profitability. What we're talking about is locking in record prices and covering them for shallow losses. I mean, that's what the debate is around now. It's centering the farm bill is not moving forward right now in Congress for three main reasons. One, they're fighting over nutrition programs, which make up 80% of the farm bill. And those aren't about plantings. That's about a nutrition safety net. Shouldn't be a conversation in the farm bill. That should be a completely separate conversation. And the other two things are Southern farmers, basically rice and peanuts, want guaranteed prices that exceed what they're getting in the market. So they want the government to come in and guarantee prices. And that's a bone of contention. And then the other issue is that crop insurance, which is a gold-plated program, where we cover on average 60% of the premiums, the cost of premiums for farmers to buy insurance that guarantees them revenue. Not that they have crops, that they get a certain amount of revenue. But that gold-plated program isn't good enough. So the farm lobby is pushing for what they call themselves a shallow loss program, which means the small losses will be covered by taxpayers. As little as 10% dip in your expected revenue, and taxpayers will write in and send checks. So what that means is they're fighting over not a safety net that's going to keep them from bankruptcy, but a safety net that's going to guarantee them profits. And that's just something that we absolutely can't afford right now.
Well, I wonder whether we can afford to, given the ubiquitous nature of it, we can afford to boycott corn. But it certainly sounds like we should, at least on Thanksgiving, be cautious about, not that most of the corn that's available now is inedible, but nevertheless, it is ubiquitous. And I think it's an important thing to point out on Thanksgiving, the irony of where we've come over these hundreds of years.
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Josh Sewell.
Right. I appreciate the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Josh Sewell, who is the Senior Policy Analyst at Taxpayers for Common Sense in Washington, D.C. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.